This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The British singer Boy George was a pop star in the 1980s. With his band Culture Club, he had such hits as Do You Really Want to Hurt Me? And I'll Tumble For Ya. His music was somewhere between pop, soul, and reggae. His look was somewhere between male and female. Culture Club fell apart in 1986, and so did Boy George, who was trying to kick a heroin habit. He cleaned up, but didn't reestablish himself in the States until the film The Crying Game. His version of the title song ran under the closing credits. Now he's starring in Taboo, an autobiographical musical set in the decadent, fashion-centric world of 80s London. The show includes some of the hits Boy George recorded with Culture Club, including their biggest hit, Karma Chameleon, which topped the charts in the States in 1984. Terry spoke with Boy George in 1995.
You know, when I first saw you perform, I wasn't sure whether the drag was just a way to get attention, you know, and you actually like went home and put on khakis and a shirt and tie, or whether, you know, you really enjoyed dressing in drag and always had.
Well, when I was a teenager, I started dressing up. When I discovered David Bowie, that was my kind of extravagant style began. In Culture Club, I did kind of look like that most of the time. These days, I'm more likely to go home and put on a pair of baggies, you know, because I like to have a distinction between what I do on stage. And there is more of a separation now than there used to be. I was kind of trapped in that image for years. I couldn't bear to let people see me looking normal. Now I don't give a damn.
What's changed for you that you don't care now?
I guess I'm more comfortable with my appearance, my physical appearance, without the armor, without the drag. So there's more of a balance, and it just makes dressing up more fun, you know, because it's not something you have to do as an obligation.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you into style before you were old enough to go to the clubs?
The first line in my book is, when I was a little boy, I wanted to be Shirley Bassey. So I've always been attracted to style and dramatic gestures. I grew up with a fascination for all things different. I used to watch those Busby Berkeley movies on the Saturday TV on Saturday, and I just always loved glamour and pizzazz.
And when did you start to try to become that?
I guess around the age of about 11 years old, when I started to really get into pop music. That was around the time of the glam scene.
Mm-hmm.
So there were people like David Bowie, Mark Bolan, all sorts of fantastic performers, and that's when I really started getting into it.
Now, when did you start to sing?
Well, I always used to sing along to pop records. I used to walk around the streets with a transistor radio to my ear, and I learned all the words to every pop song you could imagine. So I was always singing all my childhood and all through my teenage years. And people used to say, you know, you have a good voice. Why don't you try and become a singer? But it just seemed so out of reach when I was a teenager. And when punk rock came along, it really opened the door for people like me, because prior to that, you really had to pay your dues and spend years on the road. And punk kind of kicked down the door and turned everything upside down.
So what was your singing like when, during the punk era?
Well, my first band was called In Praise of Lemmings. So it kind of gives you an idea of what kind of... And we had this song, which was called Mask. And it was very... I was really influenced by Susie and the Banshees. I was a big Susie Banshee fan. So it was kind of very droney, kind of make a mask for me, all that kind of deep baritone type stuff, and very suicidal. But I soon snapped out of that.
Tell us the story of how Culture Club got started.
Well, I was in this band called Bow Wow Wow, and they threw me out. But I had the bug. I'd been on stage. I'd gotten a kind of taste of it. So I started to look for my own band. And that's really how it happened. I just rang around. And then once I got a couple of members of the band, we started to look for other people.
So one of the co-founders of the band, John Morris, who you know, was the drummer, you were lovers with him for a long time.
We were lovers pretty soon after we met. John was the kind of driving force behind the band, you know, getting things organized. He was a real sort of go-getter type person. So he was the kind of practical force within the band. Mm-hmm. We kind of fell in love within about 3 months of meeting each other. And that's really what made the whole thing so exciting. But as we got more and more successful, our relationship kind of fell apart. You know, the pressures of being successful and jealousy, immaturity. I mean, it really kind of wore us down.
In your book, you say that you actually wanted people to know that you were gay. But... John didn't want you to reveal that.
Well, John didn't want people to know about us and our relationship because, on the one hand, he felt that the media, if they knew, might try to interfere and write bad things about us. And I guess also there was a lot of fear on John's part because he wasn't very comfortable with his sexuality. But as far as I was concerned, you know, I was out of the closet at 16. My parents knew when I was 16 years old. So it was very frustrating for me to be kind of living in limbo, almost living a lie. I mean, obviously, the way I looked and the way that I behaved, I think made it quite clear to a lot of people what I was. But I was sitting on the fence and it was a very difficult thing for me to do.
What advice did your record company give you when you signed?
My record company never, ever gave me any advice about my sexuality. Nobody ever interfered. I think people don't want to talk about it. The general attitude in the business is I'd rather not know. You know, if we don't talk about it, it doesn't exist. I mean, I never had any of that. I mean, no one in my management or in my record company ever said, you know, don't say. They just didn't talk about it.
Let me play the record that was your first hit in the States. Was it, I'm going to play Do You Really Want to Hurt Me. Was that your first hit in England also?
It was our third single, but it was our first successful record.
Do you want to say anything about writing the song, how you feel about it now?
Well, I guess in those days, I was a bit of a victim. And this song is very kind of woe is me. You know, it was a song about John, all about the fact that, you know, he wasn't sort of giving 100% to the relationship and he wasn't being honest with himself. So I guess it has a certain poignancy.
Okay, this is Boy George, Culture Club. Singing Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, the first hit in the States. Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Precious kisses, words that burn me. Lovers never ask you why. In my heart the fire's burning. Choose my color, find. I thought it was interesting in your book, you say that at some point you realized that all the fans that surrounded your house and that really wanted to get close to you, it wasn't so much that they cared about you, they cared about being close to fame, being close to celebrity.
Well, I can only kind of relate it to my own experiences as a teenager. You know, I used to stand outside David Bowie's house and I used to go to radio stations and I used to touch him as he, you know, I used to try and touch him and scream as he came out of the building. I don't really know why I did that. When I think about it now, I think how ridiculous. But I guess in some way I related to David Bowie. He was somebody a little weird. He was bisexual. I knew I was gay. So he was kind of like a god to me. He was a kind of release and escape. I don't know if that's true of my fans, but I think a lot of the girls that were kind of into Culture Club and into me, I think they really recognized a certain frailty and a certain vulnerability in me. And I think that was what was the attraction.
Now, how does it feel to sing songs now that acknowledge that you're gay?
Well, I guess all my songs have, in a way, been sort of gay love songs, in a sense. In the past, they were kind of ambiguous.
I'm trying to think, you know, in your lyrics in the past, was it always like a you instead of a she or a she or a he that you were addressing?
I think it was general, you know, we kept it ambiguous. The first time I ever recorded with Culture Club, the first demos we ever made were for EMI Records. Mm-hmm. And a song called Eyes of Medusa was one of our first songs. And in that, I sang He Loves Me, He Hates Me. And there was a whole incident where the engineer stopped me and said, "You're saying he." And then the whole band had a big discussion about it. And we decided that it would be better to not alienate people. So in a way, what I've done is gone back to my original way of writing and just written from the heart, really.
You write in your book that you became trapped in your own image. You had had a lot of different styles before you really became famous. Was the image that you had when you became famous one that you were expected to keep?
Well, I don't think I was expected to keep it.
I mean, were you expected to keep, like, that hairdo and that outfit?
Well, it kind of worked. So it was. I mean, the look that I had in Culture Club was a kind of watered-down look of all the looks I'd had since I was a teenager.
Describe it.
Well, it was the big Hasidic hat.
I never thought of it that way.
Well, it was actually a proper Jewish hat that I wore.
Really?
Which was a present from John. It was actually a Frummer's hat.
Huh.
And then I wore it with sort of dreadlock braids with ribbons.
Uh-huh.
And my clothes were kind of psychedelic and baggy. Not really women's clothes, kind of blurring the boundaries. I mean, kind of androgynous, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I didn't wear breasts. I wasn't really trying to be a woman. I was really contradicting all those sort of rigid ideas of what is male and female.
What about the image of the rest of the band?
Oh, I did terrible things to them. I mean, I made them wear things that they looked absolutely ridiculous in. Once I made Roy have white dreadlocks, which was a pretty hideous look. And then there was a time in Japan when I made them all wear these kind of very tight sort of lycra shorts with clip-on suspenders. That wasn't a particularly favourite look of theirs. No, I was very bossy. I mean, I guess because they were kind of quite straight-laced, so I used to try and spice them up a bit and make them look more interesting.
Mm-hmm. When you came to America and you had become a star here and you started doing television shows here, shows that you didn't know, it must have been an interesting experience. Like in your book, you write about being on Live with Regis Philbin. And what a disorienting experience that was. Would you tell us about that?
Well, when we arrived at the show, I couldn't believe that all the audience were wearing flared trousers and wide lapel jackets and big funky collared shirts. You know, and we looked like space aliens. It was like so bizarre because we seemed like to be from another planet.
Now, you did Solid Gold. And I thought it was really interesting. You wouldn't let the Solid Gold dancers share the stage with you because why?
I thought they were tacky, to be honest with you.
Well, I have to agree with you.
I mean, I felt that the whole setup of Solid Gold was a bit 70s, and we were all about doing something modern, something revolutionary, and I just thought that they jarred with our image.
So were you really had the power to say, sorry, you can't use your own dancers on the show?
Well, I said you can use them, but just not behind us, thank you.
So,
I was a bit of a tyrant in those days. I mean, I used to pull weight a lot, you know, I used to really get, you know, very uppity about things, and I would refuse to do the show. I would just simply say, well, if they're on, we're not, you know. And of course, I got away with it a lot of the time.
One year when you won a Grammy, you said, well, why don't you repeat what you said?
I said, thank you, America. You got style and taste, and you know a good drag queen when you see one.
Now, how did you decide to say that?
It just kind of flew out of my mouth. I mean, it wasn't like I sat down and planned to say it.
Oh, you hadn't?
Oh, no, not at all. I mean, a lot of the things I say kind of just burst out, you know. And I remember after that, I was told that a lot of the people from CBS Records, who I was signed to at that time, had fallen off their chairs and were, like, weeping and, you know, kind of dying in shock on the floor. So I was quite pleased about that.
Did they say anything to you afterwards?
Well, I think that up until that point, and I say this in the book, up until that point, my sexuality had been kind of hovering in a huge question mark. And by saying I was a drag queen, I was kind of saying I was gay. So it really did change things for me after that. I mean, it kind of signaled a kind of almost like, you know, it was like almost like the end of Culture Club. Because people had always wanted to see me as this kind of sexless, inoffensive, exotic doll. And suddenly I was sort of being sexual and being provocative. And it really freaked people out.
So did it change your audience's reaction to you?
Well, I did hear that there were kind of college debates about what I actually meant. You know, people did take it far more seriously than it was, you know, than was necessary. But I guess in those days, you know, it was quite a shocking thing. I mean, now you have drag queens on every kind of, you know, movie you can see, and they're on TV all the time. But at that time, I suppose people found that shocking, you know.
You started using drugs after the band caught on. How did it change your personality when you got involved with heroin?
Well, I think drugs really help you to escape. And a drug like heroin is almost like a womb-like drug, you know. You just completely cut off from your feelings. You don't care about anybody or anything. And you almost have this kind of superior air about you that is, you know, it's hard to imagine unless you've done it.
You know, in your book you say that on tours you got into, you know, destroying expensive hotel rooms.
No, never.
Oh, That's what I thought it said, no?
No, never did anything like that. You know, when I was a kid, I used to get very upset watching Laurel and Hardy bust up these houses. It used to really upset me. I would never, ever do anything like that. I mean, that's something, I guess, you know, coming from a quite poor family, you know, my mother really had to kind of scrape to get by. And she was very house proud, so I would never, ever bust up a hotel.
I'm really glad. I just think it's so spoiled to do that.
I hate it
when rock stars do that.
Oh, no, I've never done that. Oh, no, not me. Ozzy Osbourne, but not me.
How did you end up kicking heroin?
Well, unfortunately, I lost two very close friends of mine. And that was a real sharp shock. Because I realised if I carried on, I'd be next. Mm-hmm. And certainly, you know, I had the world's media on my back. I felt like almost like a rat in a corner. You know, I really didn't have any choice because everybody was saying, please give up, you know, pull yourself together. And as I say, you know, losing my friend Michael and my friend Mark was really what I needed. And I'm sad to say that, you know, because, you know, there's not a day that goes by that I don't think of them, you know, and wish I could turn back the clock, wish I could have done something, you know.
Boy George, speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. Let's hear his rendition of The Crying Game from the 1993 film. I'm David Bianculli. This is Fresh Air.